org.
Partly sunny skies right now and 75 degrees at 11 o'clock.
In 1998, a majority of Arizona voters approved the clean election system of public campaign financing. But it's been a bumpy ride for clean elections since then. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with the Clean Elections Commission's executive director about efforts to completely eliminate the system. We'll also be joined by a lawmaker who's involved in those efforts. Plus, Governor Doug Ducey and Republican legislative leaders have been criticized by a broad group of observers for how they handled state budget negotiations. Were rank-and-file lawmakers left out? Did they want to avoid crossing Governor Ducey in his first months in office? I'll talk with Espresso pundit Greg Patterson. Also, Phoenix City Councilwoman Kate Gallego is working to get equal pay for women. We'll find out about her proposal and how Phoenix compares nationally when it comes to fair wages. And Phoenix Theater's new Works Festival is coming up this weekend. I'll talk with one of the organizers and one of the playwrights. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. After holding interest rates close to zero since 2008, the Federal Reserve is concluding a meeting at this hour about monetary policy going forward. The Fed has been saying it will be patient as the economy continues to recover. Investors are waiting to see if policymakers believe the economy is strong enough now to start boosting rates. President Obama is in Cleveland today to talk about middle-class economics. As Brian Bull of member station WCPN reports, the president may also be setting the stage for 2016 Democratic presidential hopefuls.
Obama took the battleground state of Ohio in both election bids, and it's expected that while in Cleveland, he'll champion his efforts to provide health care coverage for all Americans and boost wages for the working class, issues likely to be front and center in the 2016 presidential race. John Green is a political science professor with the University of Akron. He says at this stage of a president's career, appearances are often more about crafting a legacy than pushing agendas.
But all legacy isn't for the history books. There's, after all, going to be a new president after next year in 2017. I'm sure that President Obama would like that to be a Democrat.
Meanwhile, the GOP will have Cleveland's ear next year when the city hosts the Republican National Convention. For NPR News, I'm Brian Bull in Cleveland.
Tens of thousands of people rallied today in Moscow. NPR's Corey Flintoff reports they're celebrating the one-year anniversary of Russia's takeover of Crimea.
Although the annexation of Crimea led to international condemnation, most Russians regard it as a patriotic victory. In front of a flag-waving crowd that filled Red Square, speakers praised President Putin and popular singers belted out patriotic songs. This celebration comes as Russia showcases its growing military power. Russian military units have held more than 30 large-scale training exercises since the start of the year. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Moscow.
Benjamin Netanyahu says he'll form a new government within 2 to 3 weeks, his center-right Likud party having won a clear victory in Israeli balloting this week. One citizen of Jerusalem, Shira Ben-Sasson, says she's hopeful that Israel's newest government will be dedicated to peace and equality.
We have an obligation to not sink into the despair and into the disappointment, but try to do everything we can to bring change, to bring peace, to bring equality to the Israeli society.
Prime Minister Netanyahu's chief rival, Isaac Herzog of the opposition Zionist Union, has conceded defeat in the election. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 100, the Nasdaq up 21. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Kaspersky, giving 400 million individuals and organizations the power to protect against cybercriminals, hackers, and other internet threats. Learn more at Kaspersky.com. That's KASPERSKY.com.
Good morning. From KJZZ News in Phoenix, I'm Bruce Drummond. Police are still looking for a man who allegedly shot as many as 6 people near the EVIT campus in Mesa this morning. Esteban Flores is a Mesa police spokesman.
All we have is a white male in his 40s, a bald head, I believe a gray shirt, black pants or shorts, and he's got a large tattoo around his neck. We have, like I said, about 5 or 6 separate locations.
5 or 6 separate shooting locations?
Yes. Yeah.
One of the victims was working at a restaurant on the EVIT campus. Two others were shot at a nearby hotel. Flores could not confirm the current condition of the victims nor a potential motive for the shootings. Officials have asked people to avoid the area and call police if they should happen to see the suspect. A plan to create a new inspector general for the governor has blossomed into legislation at the state capitol. KJZZ's Dennis Lambert has more.
Governor Doug Ducey addressed the issue in his State of the State address, saying he wanted an independent inspector general to act as a watchdog for taxpayers. The IE would also investigate government waste, fraud, and abuse. The bill goes before a Senate committee today. The governor's spokesman says the delay in introducing the legislation was to get the policy right. He says by using a so-called strike everything amendment, the bill will avoid committee hearings in the state house. Dennis Lambert, KJZZ News.
The Arizona Supreme Court is letting stand a lower court ruling that said the state can't make Phoenix and Tucson move their municipal elections to even-numbered years. Supporters of a 2012 law argued that requiring the cities to hold their city elections the same years as elections for president and governor would increase voter turnout and could save money. City officials said the state was meddling, and the law could require them to extend some officials' terms of office. On Tuesday, the justices decided not to review a court of appeals ruling that the law improperly intrudes on the constitutional authority of charter cities.
KJZZ is supported by Total Wine & More's weekly wine tastings. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, Total Wine celebrates Washington Wine Month. Guests can sample a Red Waller with flavors of hot cinnamon and chocolate, a Pinot Gris, and a Cabernet.
We'll see mostly cloudy skies today in the valley, a high of 78 degrees, and we've got a 20% chance for some rain. More clouds tomorrow and a high of 81. It's cloudy in the valley right now and 78 degrees at 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, we'll meet the new director of Arizona's Department of Public Safety, Frank Milstead. We'll find out what can be done to improve relations between law enforcement officers and some African Americans, and who are the wrong-way drivers we keep hearing about. Also, there are continuing efforts to eliminate Arizona's clean election system of public campaign financing. We'll find out why, and we'll also hear from Clean Elections Commission Executive Director Tom Collins. Plus, Phoenix City Councilwoman Kate Gallego is working to get equal pay for women. We'll find out about her proposal. We start today's program with a surprising twist in the contempt of court case against Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. In court papers filed late yesterday, Arpaio and his second-in-command acknowledged they had repeatedly violated the court's orders in a racial profiling lawsuit and agreed they could be found in contempt of court. They're even offering to pay out of pocket to make it right. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block joins me with the details. Hi, Jude.
Hi.
So, last time we checked in, Judge Murray Snow had set a four-day civil hearing in April to find out if Arpaio and four other officers could be held in contempt of court. Remind us again what those issues were.
Well, you know, there had been three instances that had come to light where it was clear that the sheriff's office had not followed the court's orders. Two of those instances had to do with video evidence after Deputy Armendariz died. It came out that the sheriff's office had indeed been recording traffic stops, but they never turned over those traffic stop videos to plaintiffs early on in the case. They also failed to follow the judge's orders in how to collect video evidence from other deputies once that was known. And then the third issue had to do with the fact that as early as 2011, the judge had ordered them to stop making immigration arrests when there was no other suspicion of criminal activity, and saying that they did not have the legal authority to make those kinds of arrests. Some of that video evidence revealed that they had indeed been making those arrests after the 2011 order and had not implemented it.
So, Jude, what changed? What happened yesterday?
So yesterday, late last night, Gerald Sheridan, the chief deputy, and Joe Arpaio submitted a motion telling the judge, look, we admit that we violated your orders in these three instances. We don't deny it. And we don't need a four-day evidentiary hearing to find out if we did it, because we admit it and we admit we can be held in contempt of court. And we know that there have to be remedies for doing that. And we're going to propose a bunch of ways to make it right. And one of the things they're offering is damages for the victims, the people that were arrested after 2011 that shouldn't have been, to set up a $350,000 county fund to pay them damages. And then, get this, $100,000 that the sheriff and Sheridan would pay out of pocket to an organization that is dedicated to Latino civil rights that the court approves of. So this is a $100,000 donation they would make to a local organization.
Arpaio and Sheridan their own money? This seems odd.
I mean, that's what the court filing says, that they will personally make this donation. And it does seem odd. But I think what's going on here is that they want to prove to the judge that they are really taking this seriously and that they're offering enough remedies, sufficient remedies, that the judge can feel good about canceling this four-day evidentiary hearing that really would have gotten to the bottom of who did what and why and what kind of wrongdoing there was. Mm-hmm. And so that he feels convinced he doesn't need to refer this to a prosecutor for criminal contempt of court charges, because he had been concerned, look, I'm not sure civil penalties, the kind that you get in a civil contempt of court case, you know, which is usually fines, is enough, especially if the county is going to pick up the tab. You know, he's seen the sheriff get in trouble in the past and have county taxpayers pay his way out of it. And the judge was very clear that he didn't want to see that happen again. And so this is the sheriff and Sheridan realizing that and saying, look, we will make it hurt ourselves personally. We will do this. And, you know, hoping that by offering the sun, the moon, and the stars, that they can get out of this criminal contempt.
A two-part question, sort of, Jude, as a follow-up to that. One, it seems unusual, again, because Sheriff Arpaio doesn't back down on things. But also, does this put him in a bad light when he's been denying this for so long, and then all of a sudden he sort of says, no, wait a second, I guess we were violating.
To be fair, they haven't really denied these allegations. They've actually been seeking a settlement, I think, because they realized the evidence was so clear. And they actually brought, to their credit, they brought some of this evidence to the judge. So they did disclose this. You know, but this is a very different change in tone. We have not seen the sheriff back down or admit wrongdoing in quite this way before. I mean, even just a month ago, he announced he was running for re-election. He announced to his campaign donors that there were unfounded charges of racial profiling, you know, not acknowledging or taking seriously the weight of the court finding against him, you know, even just a month ago. So this is definitely a change in tone. I mean, even beyond the things I mentioned, he says he'll go in front of a public forum and admit his wrongdoing and explain exactly what he did. And he's also saying he's willing to drop the appeal that they have to the Ninth Circuit. I mean, so this is really going pretty far.
So going forward, any idea whether Judge Snow might be inclined to accept this? What's the next step?
Well, you know, we have to wait and see. I haven't been able to get attorneys from either side to comment on this. It was filed late last night. We're still waiting to find out. A big question remains, what about the other three guys? There were Jack McIntyre, Joseph Souza, and ex-chief Brian Sands, who were also named in the civil contempt of court case. They did not join Sheriff Arpaio and Jerry Sheridan in this admission. So we don't know what's up with them and how this will impact the future. There is a hearing set for March 20th that
so
was
Friday,
already on the books. That's this Friday. And I suspect when all the parties are together in Snow's courtroom on Friday, this is going to be a topic of conversation, to say the least.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block with the latest. Jude, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Clean Elections was approved by voters in 1998 and utilized by a large number of candidates. That participation has dwindled a bit since the U.S. Supreme Court got rid of Clean Elections matching funds provision. Now, during the current legislative session, a bill sponsored by Senator Steve Pierce of Prescott would give voters the chance to get rid of Clean Elections. And Senator Pierce joins us now from the state capitol. Senator, good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Steve?
I'm good. So give us some more background on this. What bone do you have to pick with Clean Elections?
I don't have a bone to pick. It's been 15 years since it was started, and I think it's time that we go back to the voters and just say, do you like the way it's been? Do you like the money being spent on politicians, or would you like to see it spent elsewhere? There's a lot of issues that I would put on the shoulders of Clean Elections. One is people that run clean. That's an oxymoron, by the way. If I were to fund myself running, people would say, well, that's dirty, that's not clean. Well, it isn't. It's traditional. And it's an oxymoron the way they've come up with it. But what happens is people can go to the state, file the papers, I'm going to run clean, and all they have to do is go get 200 signatures on and $205 signatures and turn that in, and they get money from the state. They don't have to go out to the public and say, well, I believe in this, or I want to hear what you have to say about that. they don't have to create anything except get money from the state and create signs and put them out.
So has that put us in a position where there are some candidates that have not been good for the state that you've had a harder time working with at the Senate?
You're very perceptive. yeah, it does. Clean elections, I think, originally, a lot of Democrats thought, boy, this is really going to help us out because it's a Republican state. But what's happened is the opposite. Clean elections has elected a lot of people on the far right and the far left. It's brought in people from the fringes on either side. But I would say it's helped the far right much greater than it has the left.
We have seen polls. There was another one recently put out by the Arizona Advocacy Network, which, you know, may lean a certain way, but they did run this poll that had still clean elections considered to be still popular among many voters, at least the ones they surveyed. Does that give you pause at all?
Well, there's others. I think there's some people out in the field right now doing some polling, and I think that if people realize, you know, it sounds great. It sounds like, oh, they don't have to go out and gather any money from anybody and they're not beholden to anybody. But that isn't true. The people that have to go out and present themselves and sell themselves, they create themselves and they create what the public wants or what these people feel like they can do to help the public. I did run traditional, and I ran originally as a conservative Republican. I'm still a conservative Republican, although there are some in my party that are far to the right of me that have left me in their dust. And they get to the far right, and you come to extremes. And what are the extremes? Well, it'd be libertarian or... believe it or not, John Birch Society is alive and well. And when I say that to young people, they're going, well, so what? Who's that? Mm-hmm. But I think you know who it is.
Yeah. Going forward, I wonder are you going to have momentum for this? And you want this to be on the ballot in 2016. And I know we hate crystal ball questions, but what if voters approve it again?
Well, then it'll be there and people can continue using it. I see a couple things that sounded good that we have done by the voters. One is clean elections, and one is term limits. Term limits sounds good. I agree with it, but it should be a longer period of time. What happens with term limits is the people just get their feet on the ground and understanding the process and being able to work on things, and they can't run anymore. And then what's left is the historical knowledge is left with staff and with the lobbyists, and that isn't good for the state. And then we have clean elections on top of that where people, you can get these other people that shouldn't be here elected, and, you know, it just makes it difficult to accomplish what we should be doing. Everybody in the legislature should be accomplishing what's good for their district and the state of Arizona, not what their personal beliefs are and not what maybe ideologues are telling them. You know, we need to have an open mind down here.
Senator Pierce, one last question for you. Based on what you're hearing from colleagues, what kind of support is there? Are you getting support from those that may be far to the right or far to the left?
There is. I think there's plenty of support down here to get the bill out. I think that we can get it out and let the people vote on it. When it gets out to the public, that's when who's going to put the money up to support it. I'm guessing Clean Elections wants to put their own money, and that's wrong, but they pay lobbyists to come down here and lobby against me. And I don't think that's right. But I think there are people, I know there are people that want to help fund a campaign to promote it. So, you know, lots of time between now and election, and we'll see what happens.
State Senator Steve Pierce of Prescott, sponsor of the bill, would have voters decide whether they want the clean election system to continue. Senator, always nice to talk with you. Thanks.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
And now we're joined by Tom Collins, Executive Director of the Arizona Citizens Clean Elections Commission. Tom, what do you think of the efforts of Senator Pierce?
Well, I think that, Steve, thanks. I think that what Senator Pierce is talking about is really an interesting, you know, almost a framing device. You know he's talking about clean elections as if it is interfering with the democratic process. But what he is saying, and what his literal words were, was it is he thinks that candidates need to be out selling themselves to contributors. Those are his words he just used with you. Now, what Clean Election does is, in the public financing aspect of it, is breaks the link between dollars and political favors and between legislators and special interests and lobbyists, and allows those legislators to go out to their district and collect small value contributions from folks in their district, as opposed to, you know, relying on this system of large campaign contributions, and worse yet, the kind of anonymous dark money expenditures that are made on behalf of candidates every day. So in a certain sense, you have a choice between big out-of-state anonymous contributors that are operating in the shadow of darkness, to whom legislators are audiencing themselves, or folks in their district who are registered to vote in the district and who are showing their support for those members. So I think if you had a choice between those systems, it's pretty clear that the public's choice is going to be in favor of the public, and the public is involved in the Clean Elections program. The public is decidedly not involved in these auditions that Senator Pierce is talking about. It's a private, separate political system for folks who are operating the shadows.
But Senator Pierce is not alone in one sense when he talks about the concern that people have that Clean Elections has led to more extremes on both sides. Now, can it be argued that that is the case, that there are more left and right people in the legislature, but Clean Elections is not to blame?
Well, there is a view that's taken hold at the legislature among certain members, including maybe Senator Pierce, who, you know, I don't claim to understand Senator Pierce's politics. That's not really my job. But I can tell you that there's a study out of Barnard College by Michael Miller in the last year or so where he went in to this and said, look, I think that's a hypothesis that makes sense to me. And it turned out it's not true. And in fact, the reasons for the polarization of our process in the country happen nationwide. There's no clean elections for Congress. There's not. Do we think that Congress is less polarized than the Arizona legislature, that Congress is getting more stuff done for the good of the people or less stuff done? I think it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat, Republican, Independent, a Green, whatever the party is. The fact of the matter is that Congress's approval ratings are in the 20s and have been for like ever. And so I think it's just a false premise. And the academic work looks like, at least the Miller study from Barnard says, it's not true. And what Miller says is, what Clean Elections does is it actually creates an opportunity for voters to spend more time with their candidates, not less. Voters, and not with the shadowy contributors who are trying to operate in the shadows and influence policy without having their names out there.
Now, you and I have talked. You've been with the Clean Elections Commission for about 5 years, and you've never had to be involved with the matching funds provision, which was eliminated before that. But matching funds seem to get a lot more candidates interested. Has the system been weakened without matching funds? Could it use something like that?
Well, you know, there's two different issues there. One, matching funds, right? I think it's quite clear that there are fewer candidates participating in public financing. But that, you know, to say that that's a diminishment of the program is to say, yes. Would the commission has said time and again it would be a better to move the amount up. When the matching funds decision was decided, the legislature also cut the amount of money available to candidates. They didn't have to do that. Mm-hmm. They did it. We would like to see that changed. In fact, if you want to be constructive about it, you could send that to the ballot. But the other thing that we've tried to emphasize, because, again, if you're framing this like a political consultant instead of like a voter, you're looking at this all backwards. For voters, what Clean Elections does is it says, look, we're going to provide you direct information straight from the candidate about each candidate, whether they're participating in public financing or not, in the form of our candidate statement pamphlets and debates. We're going to lower the amount of money on campaign contributions that state and legislative candidates, regardless of if they're participating in public financing, can take. And we're going to do independent enforcement against politicians and these dark money groups that are influencing our elections. You know, we're going to do all those things. We're going to do them in a nonpartisan way, in open meetings. And this is Sunshine Week here in Arizona and nationally. We're going to do them in open meetings where everybody can come and see each commissioner's vote, can hear them explain their positions and advocate for their side. That's what we do. So it's about openness. It's about providing information to voters. It's providing more opportunities for voters to have assurance that somebody's minding the store who doesn't have an R or a D after their name.
Tom, last thing for you. There have been efforts in the past to either eliminate Clean Elections or send it to the ballot. If this gets, first of all, how hard are you working to make sure it doesn't get to the ballot? And if it does get to the ballot, based on, again, polls we've seen recently, Clean Elections would probably do pretty well?
Well, you know, I'm not a political consultant. I'm an attorney, and I don't think that We have, and the commission has authority and continues to work to explain its position to the legislature. When it gets to the campaign, I mean, folks are going to have to make a decision if that happens. I'm pretty skeptical that there's support for this at this point. I think that legislators understand that this isn't about, this is about going up directly against voters' interests. And so I think we'll be successful in the legislature.
Tom Collins, Executive Director of the Arizona Citizens Clean Elections Commission. Tom, thanks for joining us as always.
Thank you, Steve.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll meet the new DPS Director, Frank Milstead. We'll also find out about what's going on with Mesa with an active shooter. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Eco Rehab, working with homeowners to improve the energy efficiency, health, and safety of their home with solutions to help reduce your home's carbon footprint. More information at ecorehab.net.
Good morning. This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Well, cloudy skies across most of the state right now. It's 70 degrees in Tucson, 73 in Casa Grande, 79 in Yuma. Cloudy skies in Prescott, 62 degrees. It's cloudy and 52 right now in Flagstaff. Checking valley traffic on the surface streets. Westbound Main Street in Mesa between Alma School and Dobson Road is closed right now due to police activity in the area. We proudly recognize members of our leadership society, Mr. and Mrs. Brooks Hilliard, for their support of news and information on KJZZ. To learn more about the Leadership Society, call 480-774-8444. Cloudy skies in Phoenix right now, 27% relative humidity, and it's 78 degrees at 11:26.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Mesa police have confirmed that four people have been shot at various locations near the East Valley Institute of Technology campus. One victim was working at the EVIT campus restaurant. Michael Pina was working on a car near an apartment complex when a woman ran to him, telling him to call 911.
I shut the hood. Young lady come running up to me hysterical that somebody had just slid the window to an apartment open. Walked in, got in with a gun, asked for a phone and a car key. She threw the phone at him. For some apparent way, she got out.
Pina says moments later, he heard gunshots and called the police. With more, we're now joined by KJZZ's Carrie Young, who is in Central Mesa. Carrie, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Steve.
Carrie, what can you tell us more about the situation? Do you know any more details about what's going on?
Well, we were briefed, or the press was briefed, at around 10 o'clock this morning, and we know pretty much just the basics right now. The Mesa Police Department, along with the fire department, are still trying to confirm several things. What we do know is that there are at least five or six shooting locations and at least four victims. They say that the initial calls came in around 8:30 or 9 o'clock today across from the East Valley Institute of Technology. There was one incident at the Tri-City Inn and then also Bistro 13, which is just across the street.
Carrie, how rapidly did things happen? What time did things start, and how quickly were police on the scene? Do you know?
I don't know for sure. I do know they said around 8:30 or 9, that initial flurry of phone calls came in. After that, press is here shortly after, and we were briefed at about 10:30 or 10 o'clock. So pretty quick, I'm imagining.
And what do we expect to know next? When will we have more information?
We'll have more information around noon. Mesa PD is going to be briefing the press one more time. So until then, we know the basics as of a few hours ago.
And Carrie, one final thing. Do Mesa Police still consider this to be an active shooting situation? Is that how they're describing it?
Yeah, they're describing it as an active shooting situation. They said they have several police teams and SWAT teams on it right now. So we'll get an update. I'm not sure if that is still the case, but that update will come at noon today.
KJZZ's Carrie Young with an update on Mesa Police, confirming that four people have been shot. Various locations are the East Valley Institute of Technology campus. We'll be covering this story throughout the rest of the day as we have more information. Carrie, thank you.
Thank you.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Last month, Governor Doug Ducey named Colonel Frank Milstead to be the new director of the State Department of Public Safety. Milstead's father, Ralph, was DPS director in the 1980s. Milstead had been the city of Mesa's police chief, and before that, he served 25 years in the Phoenix Police Department. I met Milstead at the DPS office not far from the State Fairgrounds in Phoenix. We started our conversation by talking about what responsibilities the agency has.
Part of my mission is to reintroduce the Arizona public to really who we are as the Arizona Department of Public Safety. There's just at 2,000 employees that work here. Around 1,150 of them are sworn staff. The rest is professional staff. We are governed by Arizona Revised Statute 41, which outlines what the Arizona Department of Public Safety will be and do. And it consists of a couple of broad areas. It's the Arizona Highway Patrol. It's statewide criminal and narcotic investigations, statewide lab services, where we provide laboratory resources to sheriff's offices and small agencies who don't own their own crime lab. We do statewide education and training for law enforcement, state gang task force, which works not only on gangs but border security issues. The other piece that's kind of not articulated in writing but is a huge asset to us is the helicopter and aviation part of the department, where we provide air rescue all around the state, which was pointed out real clearly of just, what, a week ago when we rescued all the NAU students from the North Rim of the Grand Canyon and their instructors. Without the resource of that helicopter, the sheriff's office would have been working on that for probably a day and a half, instead of the 10 hours that it took us to ferry everybody out of there.
Right now, it's almost impossible to talk about anything without addressing the state budget. Are you understaffed? Would you like more funding?
Well, you know what, and I think it's any time that you run a police department, I don't care if it's my time at Phoenix PD or my time at Mesa, inherently, because of how we're hardwired, we always want to do more, we always want to make things better. And really, under these current conditions, it's how do we lean out and really work on the statutory priorities of the department. We'll look at what we have to do statutorily, and let's be really, really good at that. And use our dollars and our staffing models to impact those things that we're required to do, and maybe not do some of the other things that we've been doing because of a project or something that we've always done. So right now, in my first few months here, I'm looking at ways to lean down the department in the sense that let's just be real good at priorities and let some other things drop away. So we are short-staffed. We were down, depending on whose count you look at, somewhere around 200 sworn positions. And that kind of ebbs and flows depending on who's counting and how they count. But there's always room for more assistance. And we look at our response times to collisions. We look at our capacity to handle the number of collisions that occur on the freeways and the Arizona State highways. And then you look at your ability to impact crime in the counties, especially with those sheriffs who count on our support.
You're someone, when you were in Mesa, renowned for accepting and embracing technology. Is that something that you'd like to see DPS do more of? And what sort of technology are we talking about?
Technology really in these current times is the key to efficiency. And if you don't have the staff, how do you make the staff more efficient? And yes, I do want to see the Arizona Department of Public Safety increase its capacity and its ability to really use technology to increase efficiency and further the agency. We struggle with statewide radio coverage, and we're trying to address that early on in my administration. We look at what's available to the officers' fingertips in the car. What can they do? And they have their mobile digital terminals, the computers. They can get calls and do some records checks, but we want to put CopLink in the cars, which is kind of the Google search engine for cops, how we share information amongst other state agencies. The ability to put two-finger fast identification, where it's a pad where you put two fingers from a person's hand on the pad, and it will use the automated fingerprint indexing system to identify who that unknown person is. And this sounds a little maybe grotesque, but we can actually do that for people that we find who are unconscious or who have been killed by some means or another, to find out who they are. You can literally identify those people as well if they're in the system, because all I need is your fingerprints. I don't need you to say it's okay. I just need you to be able to get the device to them. So if you think about when we're out in a remote location in the state, miles from help or other people to be able to identify somebody from a collision that you don't know who they are, or if there's a body that would be found would be helpful.
Why are so many people driving the wrong way on Valley Freeways, and what can be done about that?
You know, it's obviously a question of our times, and I could not have been more personally impacted when I lost one of my officers at Mesa PD, Brandon Mendoza, who was on his way home from work and got hit by a wrong-way driver on the HOV ramp from US 60 to I-10. We've had a number of deaths. There's been many injuries. And I break wrong-way drivers down into three categories. You have those who are trying to elude the police that use the wrong way to get away. You have the impaired driver by alcohol or some other substance. And then you have people who are having, for lack of a better term, a medical issue or a medical moment where, whether it's dementia or insulin issues with diabetics, but some reason that you're having a medical moment where you are not completely lucid and aware of what you're doing. But if you look at the fatalities and in number, this really all goes back to the impaired driver for the most part. And as we partner with the other agencies involved in this issue, which is the Arizona Governor's Office of Highway Safety, and that's the first one of your E's, that's education. You have the Arizona Department of Transportation, which is your second E, which is engineering. And then you have the Arizona Department of Public Safety, which is the third E, which is the enforcement piece. So how do you engineer freeways for impaired drivers? How do you engineer freeways to keep those who are having a medical moment from an incursion the wrong way? And how do you work with your local municipalities to make sure that they're doing impaired driver enforcement as well, so the people don't have the opportunity to drive on a state highway or an interstate the wrong direction? But at the end of the day, it's the same thing that we've been battling for a number of years, and that's how do you get the impaired driver off the road? Is it the designated driver program? Is it continued education? Is it increased penalties? And all those things have been worked on over a number of years. And then as we have those incursions onto the freeways, we log those, we look at opportunities to better engineer those incursion points, and we also have looked at ways that we introduce legislation maybe for enhanced penalties, or at least that if you're a wrong-way driver, that it's a mandatory reevaluation for a medical exam before you're reissued a driver's license. And if you're one of those people that's using the freeway the wrong direction to elude police, are there enhanced penalties for that?
This has been a national issue, and that's racial components. Law enforcement, whether it's Ferguson, Missouri, New York City, that's been coming up a lot as to how law enforcement officers relate to primarily African Americans. Is that a concern of yours? Is that something that Arizona is doing okay, needs to improve?
You know, there's always room for improvement, and that all that goes back to trust. Whether you're a municipal law enforcement or you're a state or a county agency, the trust of those you serve is paramount to the success of the organization. When it comes to the mistrust of the African American community, you have to realize that you go back to the 1960s. You know, you're looking 50 years ago when they weren't allowed to go certain places, they couldn't eat in certain restaurants, they had different drinking fountains. And then you go back to the 100 years before that, where slavery was part of society. The people that were mistreated in the 60s, they're still alive. They're still here in our neighborhoods. They still remember what that is. And what the police have to do is that they have to build that trust. We have to be out in the public. We have to have forums where they can participate. We have to work with the faith-based organizations to have inroads into the community. But if we don't start that dialogue, and I think the dialogue goes two ways. I think the police need to understand the perception of them by all of those demographics that exist within those minority communities. And I think they need to understand how the police react and how they respond to certain circumstances. And if we can build that dialogue and increase trust, well, then obviously we enhance the quality of life for any community, which is really what it's all about at the end of the day, is how do we make people feel safe and they can come and go and move throughout the community, in a positive manner.
Arizona Department of Public Safety Director Frank Milstead. He started his new job last month. Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about the issue of unequal pay and what the city of Phoenix is trying to do about it. Also later on this hour, we'll talk about the Phoenix Theater's New Works Festival. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Theater Company, presenting Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, the story of young love in the warring worlds of two families in La Dolce Vita, Italy, through April 12th. Details are at arizonatheater.org.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM. We'll see mostly cloudy skies in the valley today, a high of 78 degrees. We've got a 20% chance for some showers. Cloudy skies overnight, the low in the lower 60s, and that chance of showers is going to continue all the way through tomorrow when we'll have a high of 81 degrees. Stay with us. We'll have NPR's Here and Now starting at 12. Today, a reaction to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's election victory yesterday and what it means for U.S.-Israel relations. And a survey shows that men prefer reading books written by men while women prefer women authors. We'll get more on that on Here and Now from Boston starting at noon. Cloudy skies right now in the valley, and we've reached our forecast high at 78 degrees at 11:41.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The issue of unequal pay between men and women performing the same job has generated a lot more conversation in recent years, with President Obama signing executive actions to strengthen enforcement of equal pay laws for women. He also mentioned the subject in his State of the Union address in January. Here in the Valley, Phoenix City Councilwoman Kate Gallego is advocating a proposal that moves to change Phoenix's non-discrimination ordinance. The move would require city rules to be identical to federal law on the issue. And Councilwoman Gallego joins me now with more on the issue. Councilwoman, good morning.
Good morning.
So has this issue come up among your constituents, or is this one you've been thinking about for a long time?
It has come up among my constituents. I represent a district that includes the airport area, South Mountain, South Phoenix. We have a lot of female head of households who are struggling to get by, and we're hopeful that some of the training that we're proposing through this ordinance will help them do things like negotiate for a fair salary and maybe make a little bit of a difference between struggling to get by and making it.
Is it something that you've experienced at all? Have you seen loved ones go through this?
I have to say that I am personally not very skilled at asking for a raise. I was from the school where you work hard and you'll get it if you deserve it. And after a year of studying the issue, I've really learned that women need to ask for raises, as do all people, and that you ought to go in there with data and metrics about your performance and about compensation in your field and make the argument for your compensation.
How does Phoenix...
We've had a great conversation with a lot of employers who said, we are absolutely committed to equal pay and we're going to go and look and see if the people who are asking for raises are disproportionately men versus women.
Hmm. Now, the council is going to take this issue up next week. Have you talked with fellow council members? What are they saying to you about whether they would support this or not?
So we have an open meeting law, and I can't go around and collect all the votes in private.
Okay.
But publicly, I think some of them have made statements to the media that they're supportive. I think there's still some controversy in our local media about whether equal pay is a real issue. So I'm hopeful that we can get out there and present the facts and show the demographics and statistics from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that show nationally women making 77 cents on a dollar for men.
And in Phoenix, it's slightly higher than that, right?
Yes, we have good news. We're at 83 cents in our local area, so we have a lower gap than the rest of the country.
Take us through a little bit of the steps that would have to happen. What would you and your fellow council members have to do to make this go forward? Is it just a straight up and down vote?
It is.
And finally, more philosophical, this has been an issue for so long. Does it stun you that this is still an issue that needs to be addressed nationally?
We are trying to get out there and educate people about where the cause is. I think the cause has changed a little bit over time. There's less of a perception now that women shouldn't be in the workforce and should be paid less. And now it's more things like women not going out there and asking for a raise when a male counterpart is more likely to do so.
I want to sneak in one more question as well. When you have talked to your constituents, is there a feeling that this is for generations to come, that older generations of women realize perhaps they were getting short shrift and now that's why it's even more important for the younger generation to move forward?
Absolutely, and the people are disappointed that it's still an issue we need to talk about, but they also feel like the climate is right to make changes and really close that gap.
Phoenix City Councilwoman Kate Gallego, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our next guest is Jody Liggett, chair of the Phoenix Women's Commission and a member of the American Association of University Women. Hi, Jody.
Hi, how are you doing, Steve?
I'm good. Did you learn some things as part of the Phoenix Women's Commission that you did not expect as it related to equal pay? Or were you really up on this and realized this was something that is still a huge challenge?
Well, I've been active in women's issues for a long time. But, you know, honestly, I think we all had hoped it would have gotten better at this point. So in that sense, I was a little surprised that we're still looking at a gap.
So as we mentioned with Councilwoman Gallego, the city of Phoenix on average pays a little bit better, 82, 83 cents on the dollar, as opposed to the national average of 77 cents. Does that say anything specific to you about Phoenix, about Phoenix, how Phoenix is handling its business, or is this somewhat random?
Well, I don't think it's random. And in Arizona, you know, it's close to that Phoenix number. It's 84%, you know, and that is ranked number six. So, you know, one of the smallest gaps in the country. Now, if you peel back that data, though, and you look at Arizona, it's a low-wage economy. So men aren't doing well either. But that's really more of the story than women are closing the gap in Arizona.
So, Jody, if the council moves ahead and approves this modification, what sort of an impact do you think that can have? Is that something that can lead in a even stronger direction to get that much closer to a dollar versus a dollar?
Absolutely. I mean, number one, this action, you know, really speaks to all three issues about the wage gap. Number one, acknowledging that it's real. I think implicit in that is that it affects more than just women. You've got 41% of all households with women being the primary or sole breadwinner. And three, there's plenty that we can do about it. And number one, you know, under that is Phoenix being an incredible example of leveling the playing field. That's what government action can do, you know, require that discrimination not occur. And then around that, with the Women's Commission and several nonprofits, including the YWCA and the AAUW, we can teach women skill and confidence building. There is some element around this of, you know, women negotiating in a different way and needing to do that so that, you know, they're not at a disadvantage right at the beginning of their career or in the middle. You know, one of the statistics when you look at all of this is 1 year out of college, women are paid 82 cents on the dollar. Even when you control, then for major occupation, age, you know, all those things that people want to argue about, mm-hmm. if you control for all those, 1 year out of college, there's still a 7 cent gap. So certainly you can take care of discrimination through, you know, regulation, but then you can also help women help themselves by being good negotiators and understanding how to negotiate. You know, when women communicate, it's received differently in some cases. So understanding those barriers and how to work around those. And then even more importantly, just modeling a culture change that values men and women equally and values them in the workforce equally.
That culture change is interesting, especially when you mention the negotiation aspect of things. We're not in the room, obviously, when perhaps a woman is asking for a raise, but is there the feeling that if there's a male boss, his reaction to the woman even asking for a raise would be different than it would be if the man were asking for a raise?
You know what? It's complicated. Men and women receive women's communication differently from men's, right? And there are all sorts of, you know, roots and reasons for this in our culture and across cultures. But, you know, the whys we can leave to someone else, we know it's real and it exists. So, but there are ways that women can learn to negotiate effectively and, you know, communicate that negotiation in a way that will be received by the listener so that she is perceived as confident, not overbearing, and and, you know, deserving of the best possible. I think one of the biggest lessons for young women coming out of college is that they don't have to take the first salary figure that's offered to them. Mm. It's like a common misperception that these situations are not negotiable. So just having that information is power.
Jody Liggett is chair of the Phoenix Women's Commission and a member of the American Association of University Women. Jody, thank you.
Thank you so much.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. This weekend, Phoenix Theater is presenting its annual Hormel Festival of New Plays and Musicals. That includes an evening of short new plays and a 24-hour theater project. The festival opens on Friday night. With me to give us more details are Pasha Yamadahari, Phoenix Theater's resident dramaturge and assistant to the producing artistic director, and playwright Donna Hoke, who's contributed two plays to the New Works Festival, Christmas 2.0 and Survival Strategy. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
Hi.
So, Pasha, this has been around for a while, but there have been some changes to the New Works Festival. What do we need to know about if someone's going to try to attend this weekend or coming up?
Steve, this is our 17th year having the festival. Years ago, when it was founded by Dick Warren, it was a four-week festival, 1 week for each staged reading. Throughout the years now, it's become a real festival where you can come and spend up to 12 hours going from different New Work event to New Work event. So very festival-y, as our artistic director for the festival calls it, festival-y.
So obviously, this is for audiences to get a taste of some new things, to maybe watch a play by a playwright they're not familiar with. But in the long run, what kind of impact can something like this have? I mean, is this something that expands the theater experience in Phoenix? Does it have, you mentioned it's been around for all those years, does it have legs in the sense of having an impact?
Yeah, I mean, at the very source of all this is being able to foster the creation of new work, whether it's in musicals, in plays, comedies, dramas, so the audiences are able to be there at the very raw form of theater being created. And at the end of each event, each play, each musical, they're able to participate and give feedback back to the creative team as they take the next step, which hopefully will be full productions, full workshops across the country, eventually becoming part of the canon of American theater.
Do you find theater goers have to adjust? And I'm sure some of the people who go are really passionate theater goers, but let's say those who are kind of dipping their toes in the water. Is there an adjustment when they see actors up there with binders and sort of, I mean, a staged reading is a little bit different, obviously, than seeing a full production. Do people expect that when they walk in?
Yeah, I think it takes a couple of minutes to let your imagination go and to really fall into the world of the play or piece that they're seeing. And then it becomes a great exercise of the brain. It becomes this wonderful thing where your imagination is helping to create the setting, the scene. And that's where that community of audience and artists really comes together. It's a really beautiful thing to watch.
And Donna Hoke, you've been involved in writing plays for a long time, but you've got a couple new works involved in this festival. What got you involved in this particular festival? Because you're not from the Valley.
No, they had an open submission process, and I was fortunate enough to be chosen from among all the plays that they got.
Well, tell us about the plays that you have, Christmas 2.0 and Survival Strategy. What should we know about those?
Christmas 2.0 is a comedy, and the actors who have been rehearsing it are hilarious. I mean, what they have brought to it in such a short time is kind of amazing. And unlike what you were talking about, a reading with music stands, they actually are blocking. They're going to be doing the whole thing, props and everything, just with script in hand. And it's about people's failure to communicate in the age of technology. And it's set at Christmas at a time when people traditionally do try and communicate, and the frustrations that all these people are having because technology is getting in the way.
How quickly did these come to you? I mean, what is your artistic process like? Do you have quick revelations? Other times it takes you a long time to grind it out?
Christmas 2.0 actually emanated from a 10-minute play that had the same theme and was very popular and got produced a bunch of places. And then when I took a closer look at it, I realized there were all these things in it that could be extrapolated, and it kind of just happened once I realized that.
What do you think about the audience experience that Pasha mentioned, this idea that the people attending, they'll ask you questions, they might express opinions? I mean, are you comfortable with that?
Yeah, no, I'm comfortable with that. I've been through that process. I mean, most people want to like what they come to see. You usually have a couple people who just want to attack what they see. But as Pasha said, they are there to protect us, so that doesn't happen. I love hearing what people have to say. I mean, sitting in the audience, it's fortunate because I'll get to hear it three times in front of an audience, and watching the audience is about the best feedback you can possibly get. So sitting in the back and watching and seeing if the laughs are happening in the right place or if it's dead silent at a place where it shouldn't be, unless it's silent in a good way, I guess. But that's the best feedback you can possibly get. And having a production like this where they're really seeing the play fully realized in a way is invaluable.
But when you're an artist, even when, let's say, you have an editor, if you've written a book and that kind of thing, you're used to saying, okay, this is, someone is giving you that other brain to sort of dig in and say, am I getting this? Is this flowing? When you feel like, though, you have a scene that is terrific and the audience doesn't respond the way you want, do you see that as, okay, I need to tweak it, or they're not getting it, I have what I want on the page? How tough it is to balance that?
I have a friend whose favorite quote is to say, if your only defense is they don't get it, then you don't get it. And I have to agree. If the whole audience is not getting it, then I don't get it.
Pasha, what else are you excited about at the New Works Festival? What else should we know about? As far as, you know, some interesting works. We talked a little about Donna's, but other things.
Well, we, throughout the years, Phoenix Theater, as we try to really propel ourselves as well as the Valley on the national stage, one of the great things about this festival is the amount of local playwrights that are going to be involved. Phoenix Theater being big in musical theater, we've got lots of music things, composer, cabaret, lyricist. I'm very excited about, as we have composers and lyricists from around the country coming in and playing original songs that will hopefully lead to brand new musicals out on Broadway. There's a bunch of free events as well. We have a Canadian improv game called Improv is Action, which is raw theater with audience participation. It's basically like a hockey game using improv between two teams. And then finally, the 24-hour theater project, which is one of my favorite things to see. Just really, really raw theater that can create such marvels in comedy and at times drama. So just the two weekends is just full of fun stuff and also enlightening stuff, stuff that's going to make people think, make people participate.
Yeah, it's challenging stuff. I mean, and you have to, again, you have to have the audience sort of ready for that. When a festival is done, what sort of comments do you get from people? Do you get as many that say, that was amazing, to, I'm not sure I understood that, can you make stuff more conventional? Do you ever hear that?
Yeah, we're testing out something this year. We've got a festival headquarters which has a video camera so that audience members can go and give any sort of feedback on the festival itself, on plays or musicals and stuff they saw while there. The general feedback is there. We want to become nationally place that, as I said a bit earlier, fosters new work. So, and part of that is the community has to be involved. And as it's getting more and more involved in the last couple of years, I think we're starting to really have an intelligent community that understands new work development. Most of the feedback we get from our patrons that are year-round patrons and also those that just come to the festival is just having this festival here in the Valley alone is really helping create this awareness of what it takes to create theater in the country and for worldwide as well.
And Donna, though you're just in town for a short time, do you hear about Phoenix Theater? I mean, is this, when you're not here, is this an area that seems to be growing, or does it not? Because obviously it's still moving up, and it's not associated with some of those other cities, but obviously Pasha is very ambitious.
This festival is definitely on playwrights' radar, I think, and it's a wonderful opportunity for, you know, they bring you out for the week, so we all know about it, absolutely.
And Pasha, very briefly, I'm asking you for 30 seconds on this one, does it feel like the Phoenix Theater scene is strong? There have been some companies that have had to move on recently, but does it feel to you like there's positive momentum or no?
It's unfortunate to have lost a few theater companies the past couple of years because of the economics, but Phoenix Theater is constantly growing. Our season is growing. Festival is growing. Our new campus is absolutely delightful, and that whole arts corridor is becoming a real steadfast here in Phoenix, but yeah, we're on our way up.
Pasha Yamadahari is Phoenix Theater's resident dramaturge, also assistant to the producing artistic director. Playwright Donna Hoke has contributed two plays to the New Works Festival, which begins on Friday night. The plays are called Christmas 2.0 and Survival Strategy. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
And thanks very much for listening to today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. If you missed any part of the program, want to hear one of our past editions, go online this afternoon to KJZZ.org. If you have a smartphone, you can also download the KJZZ app. Special thanks to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help on today's program. Coming up next, it's NPR's Here and Now on listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. It's 12 o'clock. Have a great afternoon.